This hour with David Paulides, Bigfoot, Wild Men and Giants. And that's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. This hour, we'll be talking with David Paulides about his second edition book of Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants. And, of course, Bigfoot is not new to you, David, because you wrote a book called The Hoopa Project.
Yes, 10 years ago. That was the first book I ever wrote. And it was after spending 2 years on the Hoopa Reservation in Northern California, right near the Patterson-Gimlin site. And getting to know the elders and talking to them about the history with the biped, and then bringing in a FBI forensic trained artist to draw exactly what those people in that community, both Native American and Caucasian, had seen. And that was the first time this was ever done. Other people have just still use artists, but to bring in an FBI trained forensic artist where they know how to extrapolate the description exactly to what the person saw, it's an entirely new experience and one that reaped some great results. And after that, we decided to go towards Oklahoma in the Midwest, where we had also had reports of sightings. And we did the same thing with a book called Tribal Bigfoot. And the unique part about what we did with that section of our research, we were the only group that took an affidavit, a legal affidavit from the witnesses about the event and what they observed. That did two things. It allowed us to get an absolute legal description of what they observed, and it meant that nobody from that point forward could ever change the description of what that person saw. And a lot of times we get complaints from witnesses saying, well, yeah, this is what I reported to that website, but they're not reporting it like I saw it. They're saying it looked more apish or more gorilla, but I saw something much more human. And this is a regular routine thing with some groups that have this agenda about saying that Bigfoot is related to a gorilla or an ape.
That's right.
But the facts are, never has a gorilla or an ape bone or gorilla or ape hair ever been found in North America.
Kind of describe for us, if you could, David, paint us a picture of what some of these witnesses have described.
Normally, it's a pretty quick event. They're driving down the road, it crosses in front of them. But what we did is we dug for, I was there for 2 years, until I could find people that trusted us. And a lot of these people were community members. They'd be made fun of by the outside world, but they had close encounters, George. And I'm talking about 15 or 20 feet, a face-to-face encounter.
Wow.
And it was myself and Harvey Pratt that sat down with them, and Harvey would go through an exact note-by-note criteria that the FBI trains their artists to do, and then to draw what they observe. Like, say, a witness sees a bank robber come into the bank, and the teller gives them the money, and the person runs out. Well, that teller would sit down with Harvey, and Harvey would draw a description of what that person saw. And Harvey's drawings are so accurate that it appears that the suspect was in the room when Harvey drew his diagram.
It's almost like a photograph.
It is.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting way to get a real concise and accurate drawing of something. And we did this, I mean, I wrote two large books about it, and the affidavits were part of the evidence that we used, and it was really a unique way to do it. And from that, it was on Coast to Coast, on Knapp's show, where we initiated the DNA project, where we ended up getting 110 mitochondrial and nuclear samples. And those went through a genetics lab. They were DNA analyzed, and they were automatically taken. The DNA was taken from a machine through automation, so there was no human contamination.
Great.
Four PhDs wrote a paper. Four independent labs got the same result. And there was 110 samples. There were five nuclear samples. Those samples showed that the DNA on the female side came from 12 to 15,000 years ago in the Middle East. And it was the first time in the history of GenBank that they got accurate DNA on the male side, but it had never been entered in the 352 billion base pairs in GenBank. They couldn't explain it.
Did they come up to any kind of conclusion, or could they?
The conclusion that could be made from it is that it's some type of human hybrid.
Really?
Because the DNA was human, but it had never been categorized. And when you think back in the academic world, what this does is a bunch of amateurs, which was us, went out and initiated a project that was paid for privately to the tune of about $300,000. It could never be accepted, and we didn't understand that. And a bunch of people just went through blameless attacks on us. And unfortunately, Melba Ketchum, who was a scientist that did the DNA work, did just yeoman's work.
I remember that case. That was her then.
It was her.
Okay.
And she did a
great job. Oh, she got attacked by everybody.
Yes, she did. And really, the one guy, an individual named Scott Carpenter, he has a blog. You can look him up, Scott Carpenter, Bigfoot. And he goes through the DNA project note by note. And he shows that the DNA was accurate. He has other people, other scientists that came forward and said, yeah, this was a good study. And in fact, there was one point where actually George Knapp and I took Melba to one of the top scientists in the world that had written a series of white papers. And he explained to Melba how to write it the right way. And he said, you know, I reviewed your results. Those are dead on accurate. You did a great job of making sure that everything was done correctly.
That's fantastic.
And she took a lot of blameless hits about it that it's embarrassing to say that people don't know about the study because of these hit jobs done by fake news.
And why did they come after her? What was the rationale for that?
Because the people in the academic community have leveraged their entire career that this is a gorilla or an ape.
And that's where they get their money, their grant money.
That's the only way they can survive in their world is by sticking with their beliefs. If somebody said this for 25 or 30 years, then all of a sudden said, well, I made a mistake. You know, it's obviously a human hybrid or it's somewhere on that human spectrum. They lose their credibility. And unfortunately, there's two sides to the Bigfoot world. There's these staunch people that absolutely believe it's a gorilla or an ape. And then there's the people that look at the science behind it. And every DNA study done on Bigfoot hair and on nuclear DNA shows it's a human hybrid.
Now, tell me about that definition, though, human hybrid. What does that mean to you?
That the DNA falls on the human side of the spectrum.
But what's the hybrid part?
We don't know exactly what happened with that male side of the equation.
Could it be extraterrestrial?
Well, it's never been categorized on our world.
And so you can't rule that out.
I don't think you can rule much out other than it was a female human that was on that side of the docket. And all indications are that it was a male, but it's just never been categorized.
How tall were these creatures?
I think they run the gamut. I mean, in the work we did, they generally ran between 7 and 8.5 feet in the United States. But there have been reports in British Columbia as high as 12 feet.
Could they have been the Nephilim from the Bible, David?
You know, Scott Carpenter wrote an entire book about that. And that's a fascinating side of the equation. And Scott has taken that apart bit by bit and done a great job explaining it.
That could be a huge possibility.
Well, you know, it's strange because if it was a gorilla or if it was an ape, not of the intellect of a human, then why can't we just go out and get one?
Exactly. And how many, what do you think the population is of these things?
Well, based on witness descriptions, it's got to be in the thousands.
All over the planet?
Well, for sure, all over North America.
I mean, they're the Yetis of the Himalayas.
Well, there's the Yetis, and then there's the Almasti in Russia, and there's the Yeren in China, and there are these, and they have different names for different areas.
Is it the Sasquatch here?
I think that would be safe to say.
Now, your book, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, tell us about this one, because this is the second edition, right?
Correct, and this one came about as I was doing archival searches on people. I would start to run across these stories, and George, every story said wild men, And I would look at it and I would read it, and it would match the description of what we know as Sasquatch. And these go back hundreds of years in newspapers. And I just started to cut them out. And I thought, well, that's odd. And I started to have this giant folder filled with these old newspaper articles, straight out of some of the biggest newspapers in the world. And I started to put it together because I started to notice that there were also articles about giant bones that were found in North America and in Europe. And we're not talking, you know, 7-foot giants. We're talking 9 to 12-foot giants that were found by ranchers, farmers, and people that would just happen to be owning a piece of property. And they were found in cuts of rivers. They would be tilling the soil and they'd dig up a grave. And then they'd call a university over and they'd come. And there were many, many times that the articles that were very old said that the Smithsonian was called and they came and they took custody of the remains. And many times these remains of the giants, they would find tools and unusual metals. And these are in the articles, again, from some of the biggest papers in North America. So I started to cut these out. So what I had was, at the time, about 350-60 pages of articles, just newspaper articles.
That's huge.
It was huge. Well, then, in the last year, I sold out of those books faster than any book I've ever written. And then I started to dig a little deeper, and I came up with another 75 pages of documentation and articles that made the second edition, all supporting that every one of these old articles, George, didn't say hairy monster. It didn't say monster in the woods. It didn't say gorilla. It didn't say ape found in the garden. It said wild man. And the descriptions matched a wild man, except they had hair all over the body, very elusive, etc.
Yeah, I got to tell you, David, there's something going on this planet that is so inexplainable to people. And well, this and is I think another part of it.
I think people need to understand, too, that there's no theories here. There's no ideas I'm promoting. These are just factual newspaper articles that are by date that start in 1680 and go to 1923. And in those articles, you're going to see a very consistent pattern of a description that matches what we know today. So people say, oh, you know, people, they thought it was a bear and they just mistook it, blah, blah, blah. If you read the articles, you'll see that there's a very consistent nature in what people see, how they see it, and the mannerisms of what this biped does when it is seen. And then when you think about the giant's size of it, something's being withheld from us about giants in North America, because there's too many times where a local farmer, local rancher finds these giant things. They send a reporter out. He confirms that it's bones that are way larger than anything we have ever known, but they're obviously human. Then they send a university out. They do a forensic recovery of the bones, and then they're never seen again.
Amazing. I mean, and yet you do not tie in this with the missing people story. How come?
And I'll yell that from the highest rafters.
And you do.
And there's a lot of people and a lot of podcasts that are just outright lying. I'm saying straight up, I have never found a connection between the items, between Bigfoot, missing people, and giants. Now, they say, well, obviously, you have this research and you've done all this work on Bigfoot. It's obviously related. You're saying that, but you don't want to say it publicly. No, I'm saying that I live in the world of facts. You show me a fact that the two are related, I'll be all over it. But don't tell me about a story about a campsite somewhere that was all broken into shambles and they can't find the person. Well, unless you can tell me the name of that person that's missing from that site where there appeared to be an attack, I don't want to hear about it, because there's too many people that talk about this fabrication. Oh, you know, this person disappeared, but there's no name and there's this big cover-up. I don't believe that. Too many times I'm able to get the reports too many times, I'm able to track down who's missing. If you tell me the location and you tell me the jurisdiction, those local jurisdictions are not going to lie for the federal government. I know too many sheriffs and too many cops that would say, we don't care what the federal government tells us. We're not going to fabricate. We're not going to withhold something. We're going to tell the truth.
Are we finding any bones or anything like that?
So in the articles of the giants that were found in the late 1800s into the early 1900s, yeah, they found a lot of bones. There's some photographs in the book that show that they did find something that was phenomenal in size. And I'm not talking one or two cases. There's dozens of them. And they're scattered across the U.S. And many times they're related to what's called today Indian mounds. Either in or near the mound, they found these giant skeletons.
Now, where are they?
George,
Smithsonian?
You're asking the tough questions today.
Right.
That's the million-dollar question. And when you delve into this world, you start to figure out, well, how can the Smithsonian say that they don't have it because four papers said that they came and took them? Now, is their bookkeeping that bad that they can't find these things?
Of course not.
Of course not.
They know exactly where these things are. Now, why keep it a secret, David?
That's the part that I don't know. I suppose it would change the course of our history. And
would people freak out?
Well, you think about this, too, is that in the 1920s, we didn't have DNA. We didn't even know what DNA was. And today, with DNA analysis, can you imagine what those bones could tell us?
Well, that's true, too.
I mean, if it showed that they were from the Egyptian area, let's say, of the world, common question would be, well, how did they get here? Maybe those questions don't want to be asked.
So I think, too, though, that if it echoes the Bible, they don't want people to know that. And I don't know why.
That's a good point. Coupled with the tools and the metals that were found with them, I think it shows it's a conundrum that maybe the powers to be don't want to answer.
They're afraid of something. But I don't know what it is.
Why be afraid? Why not just face it straight up?
Yeah, and just it's a great mystery solved. Let the world know about it. If they end up being from the Nephilim, the giants of the Bible, I think the problem is it means then the Bible's accurate.
Well, here's a quick one for you. And I wrote in Tribal Bigfoot about an article I found in 1934 where a group of three tribes in the Pacific Northwest got together and held a press conference to talk about this hairy biped, and they called it a Sealotec, which is a type of Sasquatch. And the sheriff was going to go out and kill them because they were throwing rocks at hikers and things. And these tribes came together and said, no, don't go do this. You know, these things are a tribe in and of themselves. They have a language, and they trade with us. Now, this proves that they're human. Now, that was in 1934. Again, I'll say this. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, George. But why didn't any Bigfoot researcher ever find this and make this public? It's because it's contrary to their belief system that this is an ape or a gorilla. But I can tell you that three tribes getting together to hold a press conference in 1934 was a very rare event. And it was covered by the biggest newspapers in the Pacific Northwest. And it's not talked about at all at Bigfoot conferences today.
Let's come back in a moment. We'll talk more with David Politis. We'll take a few phone calls in our last segment here coming up. His work, Missing 411, The Hunted, The Trailer, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and we'll have David tell you how you can watch the entire documentary when we come back. Next hour, we'll talk about channeling and spirit guides, and when we come back in a moment, our final segment with David Paletas as we talk about his work, Bigfoot, Wildmen, and Giants, and also, of course, Missing 411, The Hunted, his latest documentary. And welcome back. We're back with David Paletas. We'll take your calls as well. David, what do you think of the 67 Patterson-Gimlin film that was shot in Northern California?
So for the people who just have a passing knowledge of the topic and really haven't gone into it, it's probably the most phenomenal piece of footage in the world ever. And I say this without any reserve at all, because at the time, there were a couple old cowboys, Patterson and Gimlin, out there with a 35-millimeter camera. There was no CGI. There was no graphics that you could easily alter the footage. And they presented, well, actually, John Green presented the footage to Disney Studios months after the footage came up and said, hey, how much would it cost to replicate this? And Disney Studios said at the time they couldn't do it. If someone was going to fake something like that, they would have faked it with a male costume. This was a female with large breasts. And there were certain injuries that when you get up close and you look at the footage closely, there was some type of injury or herniation on the right thigh that just went to the point that as it walked, you could see the muscles in the back and in the legs move. And Disney said that they could never do it.
And that was back when, around 67, they said that?
Right.
I bet. Do you think they could do it today?
I think you could do anything today.
Yeah. That's, you probably could. You could probably computer graphic the whole thing.
Absolutely.
But it is. It is an amazing piece of footage.
It is.
Really is. David, the time we have left, let's take a few calls here. Jeff in Seattle, west of the Rockies. Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, short story. Have you ever checked out the whole valley out on the Olympic Peninsula? For years, numerous sightings of Bigfoot out there on the whole river trail. Very short story. In 2000 or so, I was hiking with a friend out there, and along the whole river, as you're a half a mile from the ocean, the local Indian tribe puts nets across the river. They have sovereign treaty rights. My friend and I were stopped up above the trail to just check out this net across the river. We went another 500 yards or so, found the apple tree, sat under the apple tree, had a little break, and then walked the rest of the way out to Hoe Head, where the river dumps into the river. Now, as we sat under that apple tree having a little break, I just had this intuitive, weird feeling that we were being watched, and I said as much to my friend, and he didn't really feel so much of it, but literally the next night, my friend called me and said, Jeff, did you check the news? Well, that night, after we'd gotten back to the car, the Indian person who had set those nets in the whole river had reported looking across the river and seeing a Bigfoot. It made the news, the local TV channels, either 2000 or 2001. Long history in the whole river valley of Bigfoot activity.
I remember that story.
We hiked it, boom, the local tribal fishermen saw a Bigfoot in that area.
Must be hundreds of cases like that, David, out there.
Well, actually, that area that he's talking about is very active still. There's a retired police detective named Rich Germeau that lives outside of Port Angeles that's a good friend of mine who's done a lot of work in that area, one of the most credible researchers ever. And he's had a couple of sightings along the Olympic Peninsula that validate exactly what this caller's saying.
There was a dentist out there in the Washington area that spotted, I mean, great credible witnesses have seen some strange creatures.
George, you'd be surprised the cross-section of the world that has had an incident like this and just doesn't want to say anything.
No. Do they freak out?
I think they're afraid what others will say.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, if you saw it, you'd say, you know what? No one's going to convince me what I didn't see. I saw what I saw. And if people want to make fun of me, hey, I don't need that headache. I'm convinced in my own mind. Let it be.
At this point, if you were to take evidence to court as a former police officer for the missing people primarily, would you say that you had enough information to take to court?
For what?
To not say convict somebody, because we're not convicting anybody, but to prove a point.
No, I don't.
You couldn't do it, could you?
I think I could easily prove that it's outside the realm of all normal search and rescue protocol, and it falls at the extreme end of unusual. And in the documentary that's released within the last hour to the public, I think the people will quickly realize when they see the sheriffs that we've interviewed that this falls within the realm of highly, highly unusual.
Oh, they're baffled. You could see it on their faces. In some cases, some of them look scared, David.
No, I think that's the way law enforcement is when they don't have an answer. They don't like to be put in that position, but I think that they felt comfortable enough with what I put in front of them that no one's going to argue with the facts that they present. And the facts are the facts.
And what's fascinating to me is the law enforcement does not try to pinpoint what could be obvious to some people, and it's not. I mean, you would say serial killers are out there, or somebody's out there hiding, jumping these guys, or mountain lions are taking them, but they don't go that way.
You know, what one of those sheriffs did admit, though, that was, I think, monumental in my world, and I've talked about this on your show, that I've been out in the woods before, and there it goes to a dead silence. And you sit down, and you wait 10 or 15 minutes, and then the crickets come back, and things come back, and it seems like the world all of a sudden comes alive. Well, in one of these scenarios that we presented, the hunters went out, and even the hunters admitted, this should have been just tons of wildlife, and they didn't see any. And when I asked the sheriff and his search team if they had seen wildlife, he said, it was unusual. We didn't even see any squirrels.
Well, what's interesting about a cricket, because I've seen many crickets, I know crickets, and when you're not close to them, they're chipping away. But as soon as you get close to them and they can sense that, they go dead silent. So to me, what you've just said tells me that there's something out there that they have picked up on, the crickets, and they go dead silent when that thing's around, whatever it might be.
And I think, George, that animals and insects and things in the woods may have some sensory abilities that we don't have.
Well, there's no doubt about it. Look at the tsunami that hit Indonesia years ago. The tigers and elephants, they head for the hills way before people even realized something was wrong. They were gone. They have that extra sensory perception within their system somehow. We've got Kevin, truck driving in Iowa. Welcome to the show. Hi, Kev. Go ahead. You're on with David Politis.
I've told this story before on your show, and the person I was talking to at that time had a tendency to disbelieve it. But when I was 8 years old, we went to visit some relatives down in Brennan County, Kentucky. And my uncle had sent me through the woods to an old apple orchard on an old homestead there to see if any were ripe to bring some back. And I'd filled up a rucksack and I'd started back, and coming through the woods, I stepped into a small clearing. At the same time, something 8 feet tall, very hairy, stepped into it too, and we stood there and stared at each other for a few seconds. And I noticed that he was looking at the apples that were in my hand. And I was looking for some place to duck into to hide. Didn't want to try to run because I was told never to run from large hairy creatures. And I sat down next to a deadfall tree that there was a hollow I could have crawled into. But I set the apples on the deadfall tree, and the creature came up and sat on the far side and started eating the apples, and we got a really good look at each other. He was about the color, have you ever picked walnuts and got the rind stain on your hand, you know, that kind of clear brown?
No, my effort of walnuts are in the supermarket. That's it.
Okay. Well, anyhow, he was kind of a dark, clear brown. He had a face that was, well, more human than animal. Mm-hmm.
Was it a hairy face?
No, not really. The hair surrounding the face was heavy. He had it on his neck and chin, but his face was pretty smooth.
Coconut-shaped head?
No.
Okay.
No.
And you would, though he was sitting, would you guess his height?
About 8 feet.
About 8 feet. And now I'm very curious, Kev, what happened? Where did he go?
Well, it gets better. We sat there for probably 5 minutes or so. He was eating the apples that I was sitting on the tree. And I heard a noise. I looked up behind him, and there was a female who was a little smaller, obviously very pregnant.
Were you scared?
Yes. Yes.
To put it bluntly?
It's an experience I'll never forget.
Kevin, what year was that?
Well, let's see. I'm 61 now. I was 8 then.
53 years ago. Let's do a little.
Yeah, pretty much. Let's see. It would be, I was 8.
1966.
Okay.
Right around that.
Hey, right, Kevin, there. Kevin, do me a favor. Send me an email at missing411@yahoo.com, and I want to hear from you.
Missing411@yahoo.com.
Okay.
And you said the female creature was pregnant.
Yes. And she never sat down. She stayed behind him, and he would hand her an apple every once in a while.
With human-like motions or more animal-like?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. No, he stood upright, just like a man. There was no stoop to him. His hands were huge, but no claws, just fingernails like ours.
At any point, Kevin, did you feel threatened?
Not threatened, but it took me a good 3 or 4 minutes to stand up to get my legs under me after they left.
And when they left, I mean, how did they leave you? Did they just look at you and walk away or what?
Once I ran out of the apples, he sat there for probably maybe another 30 seconds or so and just got up, turned, and walked back into the woods.
Well, good thing he didn't think of you as the last apple.
Yeah, no kidding.
Huh. All right.
What was the closest city?
Pardon?
What's the closest big city you were at?
That would be Hazard, Kentucky.
Hazard, Kentucky. Okay, that's not...
I hope to hear from you, Kevin.
Definitely, definitely. That's amazing. David, how can people watch the Missing 411, The Hunted?
Well, the links are on the Coast to Coast website, but if you go to CanAm, like Canadian American, CanAmMissing.com, and go to Missing 411, The Hunted, there's a link there to watch the trailer, to purchase the Hunter book, or to purchase online editions of the movie and the DVD.
And how about the Bigfoot Wild Men and Giants second edition? Can you get it there too?
You can get it on that link on your site, and it's there right now. And George, I sincerely appreciate the feedback on the movie, and I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, it was a great movie. It was riveting. I watched it last week when you sent it to us. And, like if this was a movie at home, I couldn't get up and leave. You just had to watch it, and every scene just captivated you. There's something going on there, David. I mean, you're on to something. Are you the only one in the country studying this?
Well, if there's somebody else, they haven't contacted me.
No, and we don't know about them.
Yeah, and you'd think you'd know.
just truly remarkable. It really is. We might have time for one more quick call.
Sure.
Not even a story. Let's see. Joel in Buffalo, New York. Joel, we only have about 2 minutes left, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, hey, George. Hey, Dave.
Hi there.
Quick question, Dave. Are you familiar with Todd Standing?
Of course.
Yeah, I haven't heard anybody bring him up, and that's some of the most precise, clear-cut evidence I've ever seen. And someone's either going to dismiss him as a fraud or believe him. And if you do believe him, I don't know why more people are not embracing the abilities he has and the evidence he has.
He seems to be a great researcher.
Yeah, the pictures are so perfect. It's like they're discounted as being fake. You can't win one way or the other. They're either too grainy or too good, but it's amazing with the pictures he has. And I just want to get Dave's reaction to.
All right. Go ahead, David, a minute left.
Well, I defer to my buddy Les Stroud, who spent a lot of time with Standing. And Les said that, you know, either he's the best faker in the world or he's the best Bigfoot researcher in the world. And he goes, there's really no middle ground.
And it's just an amazing story. And at no point are you tying in Bigfoot with these missing hunter people, right?
No, I'm not.
You're not.
There's no evidence to point to it.
I can't. I keep trying to pull you into that, and I can't.
So good try, George.
stay your ground. David, say hi to your family for me and be well, okay?
Thanks a million, George.
David Politis, true researcher extraordinaire. Just an amazing story. Up next, we are going to be dealing with Beyond the Known, Realization, Channeling and Guides in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and also sign up and subscribe to our free YouTube channel by going to Coast to Coast AM Official in the YouTube search bar.